You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good post-Super Tuesday morning, Matt.
I don't like to use the word hero to describe me. And I don't normally think of you as being clairvoyant, but... I think both of those things are
well,
true.
I wouldn't say I'm clairvoyant. I didn't predict everything. But if you go to my Twitter feed, I did just lay out every article that I've written in the past 3 years that has been on the money. And so it's not on the money in that I think Joe Biden's going to win. On the money in that I've been telling folks for about 2 years that the Democratic electorate is more moderate than populist, certainly more moderate than socialist. And that's a favorable electorate to Joe Biden. And if you're going to beat Biden, you need to understand what the electorate is and not, you know, get caught up by the hype and the what it became conventional wisdom. And I think that has been completely borne out in what happened last night.
Well, and your Politico magazine piece about Iowa really turns out to have been Prussian. I mean, South Carolina seems to have been a much more important state, obviously.
I wrote in November in Real Clear Politics, I had a piece, what's more important, Iowa or South Carolina? And you, just looking at the past history, and, you know, we've only had this schedule since 2008, where Nevada and South Carolina are right after Iowa and New Hampshire. But in those two races, the winner of Iowa did not win New Hampshire. There was not enough momentum out of Iowa to carry New Hampshire. And the winner of New Hampshire did not win South Carolina. I mean, you could argue in 2016, Bernie got momentum out of Iowa because he kept it close and had the landslide in New Hampshire, but that didn't carry forth into Nevada and certainly not South Carolina. And South Carolina is so important because it's not just that it's a state. It is a majority African-American state that has voted similarly to the other majority African-American states in the Deep South. And
you're talking about
in the Democratic primary,
yes.
And also has some relevance to the upper South states where it's not majority black, but it's still, you know, 20-30% black. And, you know, I wasn't confident that Biden could lose Iowa and New Hampshire this badly and still win South Carolina. But I did say, right.
That was the question. That was always the question. He could finish third or, you know, but what would happen if he, you know, if he finished fourth or fifth? And then we tested that out.
I just want to say,
we still don't know yet, by the way. We still don't know, of course, who's going to win the nomination or if it'll be brokered, but what we do know is that Joe Biden has had a stunning comeback.
Right, and it's because because South Carolina, what I did say in both that Real Clear Politics piece and the January Politico piece, Iowa matters less than ever, which was based more on candidate travel than past history, but the two pieces are obviously very complementary, that you can't assume that the majority black state is going to just say, whatever you white guys think, we're going to do that. They were going to act independently. I mean, they could have concluded that Biden was not viable and go somewhere else. And they almost did, mind you. There was a buckling of that firewall in the polling after New Hampshire. But obviously Biden still had.
Well, Jim Clyburn, you know, that
obviously helps.
Apparently.
But this gets back to some other pieces that I've written. I talked about it back in September how Pete Buttigieg was up against the wall with black voters and all this early donor money was probably going to be for naught. And in December, I wrote another piece about Buttigieg and Warren, how they need to have some kind of pivot to win, the black vote and the working class white vote. Because you can't show up in a majority black area as a white candidate, not familiar to anybody, and say, I got these amazing plans. You're going to love them. Trust me. You're going to love what I'm going to do for you. They're going to say, I don't know you. I have no reason to trust you. This all sounds nice, but you know, we've seen a lot, and we want some proof that you're going to deliver. You need to build relationships over years. You can't just show up right before an election, or even 1 year before an election,
or run ads. And that's the other thing. That's the other thing where I think you were right. You were always very skeptical of Michael Bloomberg's money and his ads. I was pretty worried that Bloomberg was going to mess up things for Biden, like in Texas, for example. But the ads didn't resonate as well. And in South Carolina, so Bloomberg wasn't on the ballot in South Carolina, right? Tom Steyer was. And the money didn't, and the ads didn't seem to matter. I think that, and I wonder why, I was tweeting about this today, like, why is it that the Republicans in 2016 weren't able to stop Trump? You know, why was it that they didn't, why is it that Pete and Amy got out right away and sort of made the right move at the right time, the right sacrifice to help Biden to stop Bernie, but Republicans didn't do it? And, there's a lot of differences. It's not a perfect analogy, but one difference is Democrats have the African-American community. And I think that that community was more tight-knit, and culturally they were not susceptible to just the TV ads or something. You had to campaign. You had to know. And Joe Biden, you know, has kind of paid his dues over the years. So it's a thing where in the Republican electorate in 2016, we saw it in Utah a little bit. We saw it in Wisconsin a little bit. Places where there's high social capital, right, where people join bowling leagues, didn't like Trump. But places that don't know their neighbors were very susceptible to Trump. And I wonder if there's something at work there in favor of stopping Bernie.
Yes, so to what you were saying just a little bit before, you know, we can't assume Biden has a glide path from here. Biden can always make mistakes. Biden is not, you know, an infallible candidate, as we well know. And who knows what might fall out of the sky. But Bernie's not going to beat Biden on ideology. I think that is clear after what we have seen. The Bernie premise. I mean, there's a Bernie premise and a Bloomberg premise. You know, the Bloomberg premise was, I can win this with money and ads. Well, we had a political science experiment last night. What's more important, free media or paid media? And free media blew paid media out of the water. And we also had a bit of a ground game experiment. Once you get past Iowa caucus or Nevada caucus, how important is ground game versus free media? Biden had no ground game whatsoever. Bernie has been working his volunteer network for years. They talk on and on how many doors they knocked on. And once you get into primary states, people have not been paid close attention to the way you do in Iowa and Nevada in these early states. Free media, free media, free media, free media.
Momentum.
Well, I mean, you know, the two are in lockstep. So what does Bernie do now? I mean, Bernie's speech last night was your standard Biden attack speech. He voted for the Iraq war. He voted for these trade deals. He's not the right candidate to defeat Trump. He can't energize the base the way I can. If you're energizing the base in a Democratic primary, you would be winning more contests. Now, I mean, there's a legitimate question how Biden can handle
the turnout, by the way, right? Places that had the highest turnout were Biden states.
Right. I mean, this notion that, look, Bernie crushes it with the young. That is indisputable. If you want to argue Biden is going to have a problem in a general election because he can't bring out the youth vote, I'll hear that argument. That's not a crazy argument. But turnout is not just young people. Other people vote. Other people can turn out in higher numbers, including, you know, moderate suburbanites. That seems to be what's been going on right now. And the Democratic Party.
I mean, you know who else turned out? Me.
Yeah.
I voted.
And you voted for Joe Biden.
I voted for Joe. And this, you got me thinking about it last week. And I really wrestled with it. And I don't even think, I mean, I don't even think I could have voted. I went into my precinct, and normally they say, do you want to vote a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot?
Right.
And I don't even think you could vote a Republican ballot.
Did they shut down the primary in Virginia for the Republicans? So that I know it's happening in some states.
They must have. Either that or it's just such a Democratic precinct they assume. But they've always asked in the past, and it was just the presidential. But first time I've ever voted in a presidential Democratic primary. I think I voted for like mayor of Alexandria or something, but like literally there wasn't a Republican to choose. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like it was just Democrats. So what an interesting experience. And then I went on TV. I wrote a column for the Daily Beast about it, explaining it. I'm getting a little pushback. Some people are upset that I would not commit to vote for Biden in the general.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to explain that in my piece.
So a little pushback on that. You might go non-voter again in 2020?
Well, you know what I'm thinking is that I'm going to vote, but it'll either be third party or I'll write in something. And basically, I've decided to do that for the sake of optics. I've discovered that saying you're not going to vote really pisses people off. Tucker Carlson said that he didn't realize until he quit wearing a bow tie that wearing a bow tie is like walking around with a giant middle finger around your neck. And it occurs to me that saying that you're not going to vote really angers people for a variety of reasons. So I think I'm just going to like disarm that by voting, but I just won't vote for any, you know, I won't vote for Trump, and I won't vote, probably won't vote. But you know what? Win my vote, Democrats, if you want it. Never say never. If you want my vote, try to win it.
Well, I'm curious, to what extent are you representative of something? I mean, there's all this panic about Operation Chaos and Republicans storming the Democratic primary. You got a lot of open primaries where you literally can just walk, doesn't matter what your primary registration is, you can just walk in and vote for Democrats if you want to. Virginia is one of those states. There were several last night.
There were like 10 out of 14, I think.
Right.
I mean, something like that.
And when you have no Republican primary on the ballot.
It's a little confusing because in some of the states, the Democrats let you do it, but the Republicans don't. So, but I think yesterday, like around 10 of the states, you could show up and vote in the Democratic primary.
And,
you know, if you were registered as a voter, but you didn't have to be a Democrat.
And then, you know, Trump was implicitly encouraging Republicans to vote for Bernie. There are Republicans in certain states openly saying, I'm voting for Bernie to screw the Democrats. Hugh Hewitt, when I meet the press, is he going to vote for Bernie in Virginia. But how many
I'm voting for a socialist because I'm a conservative.
But how many Republicans,
doesn't make a lot of sense.
How many, you know, center-right Republicans or anti-Trump conservative Republicans said, I'm going to vote for Democrats because I want to have a decent person be, not to say Bernie's indecent, but from the perspective of that that voter, I want to have a decent Democrat on the ticket and have a reasonable, you know, discussion.
Someone who embraces liberal democracy and the norms of the American system, which you're not going to have with a socialist on the left or a right-wing nationalist on the right. Look, you know, how many never Trump, you know, people like me are there? We could have our meeting in a phone booth. But I think that there's probably a lot of people who are, you know, college educated suburbanites who tend to be somewhat conservative, who vote Republican sometimes, who decided to embrace what I call Operation Normalcy, hashtag, and cast their vote for Biden. And look, I justify it because I justify it on a couple of counts. I was not meddling in the Democratic election in an attempt to hurt Democrats by elevating the worst and least electable candidate. I was meddling in the Democratic primary in order to nominate the person I actually believe would be the best nominee, both in terms of what's good for America, should he win, and in terms of what is more likely that Democrats would actually win the Electoral College. So I felt that that what I did was ethical and justifiable.
It was a good faith
even
vote.
Even though it's meddling. Admittedly meddling.
I wouldn't call it meddling. You, I mean, under the law and the rules of the party, the Democratic Party has democratized, small d democratized the primary process. They have said this is an okay thing to do. I mean, there's arguments against doing that. There's arguments for closed primaries to say you shouldn't be allowed. But by and large, most states allow you to do that. You went in there, I think, in good faith, trying to pick the nominee you think would be the best thing for the country. I wrote a piece, I think it was 2018.
So, like, let me just say, though, in terms of being a hero, like, Jim Clyburn here, Matt Lewis, maybe. So, like, I don't want to say I led a revolution or a movement, really, but, you know, it worked.
What's up? I mean, not just you put it out there on the Daily Beast, not a small site. You created the permission structure for other Never Trumpers to do that. Now, I had a piece, I think in 2018, why the smart move for Never Trumpers is to become Democrats. Do you remember that piece?
I do.
And I got mocked a lot by Never Trumpers and other Republicans. You know, why would I ever want to be in this, you know, godforsaken party? Why would I ever want to buddy up with a bunch of socialists? And the argument was, if you're not thrilled with Trump, you think Trump is corrosive to democracy, and you don't want the Democratic Party to become a far left party, you can effectively join the party, which at least temporarily, Matt, you have done. You are
did for one day.
You are a Democrat for a day.
But here's the other part of that equation, Bill. There was no chance to vote really for a primary. I mean, if there'd been a chance for someone, if Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz had played their cards differently and had run a vigorous primary challenge against Donald Trump, which in hindsight is an absurd idea, but 2 years ago, maybe you might have thought that it's within the realm of possibility, or 3 years ago, maybe, or whatever, whenever you wrote that piece. So, like, there's a scenario where I would have voted in a Republican primary against Trump in good conscience.
Sure.
But, like, that wasn't even an option.
Right. But I think the never-Trumper Republican gets more out of being a Democrat and saying, look, I'm going to be in this party now. I'm not going to get my way on 9 out of 10 things. I'm not going to make it a pro-life party. I'm not going to make it a low-tax party. But I could ensure that it's not a Democratic Socialist Party. I could ensure that it is an internationalist party. I could ensure that when it's crafting whatever domestic policy, that it hews more to a center-left line than a hard populist line by saying, look, I am in this party. My votes actually help you. And even though I'm not a majority faction of the party, you have to listen to what I have to say here.
That's what I did without taking on the baggage of affiliating and associating myself with things that I find, you know, I don't want to say morally reprehensible, things that I disagree with.
Right.
Okay. Now, look, if you want me to, like, the whole reason I became a rugged individualist contrarian is I don't want to go to meetings. So, you know, if you want me to go to, like, a committee meeting and vote, you know, for who's going to be my precinct chair in the Democratic Party, that's probably not going to happen. But will I show up every 4 years and stop Bernie Sanders if I can? Yes, I will. if that makes me a joke right now, I don't know.
Now, to go to your other point about, because you touched on this a couple of times, you know, whether, you know, Democrats seem to be doing what Republicans couldn't do and stopping their factionalist candidate. Number one, I think Republicans could have stopped Trump. I think they had the numbers to stop Trump. They could have at least tried to consolidate around a Jeb or Rubio or even a Ted Cruz. But one, they were too factionalized. I think they're the moderate establishment Jeb, Rubio, Christie types were different people than the Ted Cruz evangelical types. And they couldn't find a way to come together to stop Trump. And there also was a lack of basic will amongst the Republican leaders because there were certain things that Trump was preaching, I think in particular immigration, which were majority views within the party.
Sure. Well, certainly within the base, it turns
right,
out.
Right, and they didn't want to get on the wrong side of that. In this case, you know, the Bernie philosophy, the Bernie strategic approach to this race was, we only need 30% or so in the early contests, and then we can get the bandwagon effect after that. And so we're not going to do anything to remotely dilute the Bernie message in the first four states. Not substantively, not symbolically. We're bringing out AOC. We're bringing out the Squad. We're bringing out Michael Moore. We're bringing out Marianne Williamson. You know, there is no pivot in the first four states and Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And there was one poll came out in February that showed Bernie winning head to heads with the other Democrats. And I got lots of up in my grill saying, aha, you're wrong. This is not a moderate party. Look at this poll. And I'm saying to myself, I mean, look, it's a poll. I'm a pretty poll obsessed person. I'm not going to say it's a wrong poll, but it is one poll out of a lot of data that I've been absorbing over the last 2 years. In the midst of Biden's nadir, I'm not convinced yet that this is the poll that tells you everything about the party. And now, based on last night, I bet you run those head-to-heads today, you're not going to get Bernie winning head-to-heads with Biden. We'll see. You know.
I am curious about the fact that these Democrats like Pete and Amy they defied the perverse incentives. Certainly Pete did. By getting out,
I think they made the rational. They went on rational incentive. And look, and Pete deserves credit here. I mean, number one, I think the data shows that they sided with the majority wing of the party, and they ensure that the majority wing, or have almost ensured the majority wing will prevail.
Even Beto, I mean, give Beto some credit.
Yes, absolutely.
Where's Kamala, by the way? Where's Kamala Harris? Did she ever?
No, she's not endorsed yet.
Like, wouldn't you think do that in California?
Well,
you want to be the roommate?
I mean, a little harder for Kamala in that Bernie's strongest state is arguably California. Now, it looks like he's not going to win it with the kind of margin he was hoping for. But there are clearly a lot of Bernie-crats in California, so that is a bit of a trickier position for her to be in.
You want to be the running mate?
She might have sacrificed running mate in not endorsing.
Interesting. I'm going to get back to the differences, though, between why Democrats did what I think is the responsible thing. And I think there are a couple scenarios or a couple of differences, right? So, like, one is Democrats got to watch what Trump did. So they got to see what happened to the Republican Party in 2016.
Yeah.
So, like, I think Republicans thought the idea that Trump could win was absurd. Mm-hmm. He can't win.
Right.
And therefore, we just got to stay in and beat up the guy in our own lane, and Trump is going to – there's no way he could win. And by the time they figured out he could, it was too late. So Democrats have the benefit of having seen what happened to the Republican Party. Like, that's one theory.
Yeah.
Another option is that Barack Obama is much more popular with Democrats than George W. Bush was, and therefore the Democratic Party still has some semblance of an establishment. And I don't know if Barack Obama made a phone call to Pete, but if he did, Obama has more leverage and credibility.
We know they talked. We do know they talked.
Yeah.
We don't know what was said.
So the Democrats have, I mean, I'm not saying that Obama is the boss who gets to call the shots, but they still have some semblance of leadership and adult, like an establishment Democrats don't have Fox News and Rush Limbaugh to contend with, right?
If he has Bernie folks, they'll say MSNBC is anti-Bernie Central, and that's helping them along.
Then there's also the winner take all delegates versus the, so I mean, but it may just be that Democrats, I mean, I'm curious why it is, and we may never know the answer.
If you're Pete, I mean, and Pete started this, if you're Pete, do you have a home in a Bernie Sanders-led Democratic Party? You do not. There is nowhere for you to go. You're not getting a cabinet post in a Bernie Sanders-led party, or you're not going to be DNC chair. I don't know what you're going to do. Maybe you can be a CNN pundit. So I'm sure, I mean, there was an article in the Times about how much of a data nerd, political data nerd Pete Buttigieg is, and he was telling Dave Wasserman from 538 at Cook Political Report before New Hampshire what counties and precincts he was going to win in New Hampshire. And Wasserman was like, that guy was right. He knew it. He knew where he stood on Super Tuesday.
It's like if Steve Kornacki ran for...
Yeah, well, it really is. And he knew where he stood. He knew he was not going to get any delegates on Super Tuesday, and he made the wise, rational decision, better to not suffer that humiliation and engender the goodwill of consolidating the moderates in the party behind Biden first. But to do that, emotionally to do that, in a 24-hour period when you've invested so much energy over the past year, I think is a hard thing to do, and that's why he deserves credit.
You can't think about it. You can't sleep on it.
Yeah.
You got to make that call. That's like a game day gots to make decision.
So. Now Klobuchar, I think myself and a lot of other people thought Klobuchar should stay in and keep Minnesota out of Bernie's hands and then drop out. And so I don't know if either one, she saw her numbers were dropping and she wasn't going to win anyway, or two, she's had to stick it to Pete one last time and not let him get all the glory. But either way.
Let me just say, Elizabeth Warren, third place in Massachusetts, and and Biden wins Minnesota. I mean, there were a couple of really surprising
states he did not campaign in, did not run an ad in. I thought Biden had an outside shot of, you know, contesting Massachusetts with the consolidation if Bernie and Warren split the left vote here, but I really didn't think he was going to win it, you know, going away. I just want to say, full disclosure,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
My wife is a Warren endorser. She's a city council president, so she's like on the list of like official Warren endorsers that they put out. And I live in one of the very few cities, I think, in the entire country that Warren won, although not by a lot. Bernie was a close second, and Biden was a relatively healthy third place here, which actually I was kind of shocked by, because I literally did not meet a Biden voter before going to the polls myself. I think people were genuinely shocked. I mean, everyone that I knew at the election night party, which is all the politicos in town, people were genuinely shocked that Biden did that well here.
This will sound like a cheap shot, but, I've written some critical stuff about Elizabeth Warren, and one of the pieces I wrote where I said I don't think she's very likable, and some people took that to be a controversial, possibly misogynistic thing to say. And my response always was this: she can prove me wrong. She can go win the nomination and prove me wrong. I'm not saying I'm necessarily right, but she certainly didn't prove me wrong.
Well, no, I mean, she made her own mistakes, and I think it's fine to a point to talk about sexism and misogyny in the campaign. Sexism and misogyny is real. So that is, you know, internalized. I mean, there was a quote in the paper, in my local paper, from somebody who was a woman, who said, I'm afraid to vote for a woman and have that heartbreak. It's not just people being outright sexist themselves. So I don't think that is a non-factor here, but it is just a factor if you're running as an African American, or running if you're gay, or running if you're old, or running if you're a socialist. Like everyone in this field has some kind of weakness that they have to overcome. Yeah. Weakness in a political sense. And you know, Barack Obama was someone who had to show, I know I can navigate the history of racism in this country. And Elizabeth Warren was successfully doing that for a period of time. She was down and out at the beginning of 2019. She got up off the mat, one plan after another. Great. People said she wasn't likable. She had these great speeches and great crowds that showed I darn well am likable. And she was running a masterclass in policy in these speeches. And it began to fall apart when, after establishing herself as the master of detail, she was unwilling to give details on single-payer health care. And then after, under pressure, finally coughed up those details, realizing this is not tenable. I can't be the master detail and not have details here. Found out, as everyone does, the details of healthcare are a giant, colossal, you know, S show.
Wasn't it Donald Trump who's like, it turns out this is more complicated than I thought.
And of course, Liz Ward knew full well how complicated it was, which is why she probably didn't get into it in the first place. So the prior mistake was going all in on single payer at all, which she did not have to do and did not do back in March. She made the miscalculation. The electorate is more left than it is, and got in too deep. And it's because of that she was on the verge of showing, I can beat misogyny. I know how to overcome this. And then once she failed to meet some of her own standards, that's when the wheels began to come off. And to the folks who say, well, she got a race in the media after Iowa, you know, Klobuchar got this unfair bump out of New Hampshire, and people still obsessed about Biden, even though he did worse than she did. She got fantastic media out of her debate with Bloomberg in Nevada. She had the free media for a few days, and she could not translate it into votes in Nevada, and that's when it started to fall apart again. So I don't think it's correct to say that everyone forgot about her. You have to earn the media that you get, in part with debates or whatever, but then the votes have to come in to keep getting that free media. Biden got the votes in South Carolina to get that free media.
2 weeks ago, which sounds insane now, 2 weeks ago I was saying, let's all get behind Amy Klobuchar, right? So that's how much of a misogynist I am, is that I wanted Amy Klobuchar. And hindsight, you know, she probably not a great idea. But I, you know, and I know, look, it's hard to argue with the data. You can point to when the polling shifted on Warren, but I still believe she just had a fundamental personality flaw. Crazy Bernie's actually likable.
Well,
Biden
is
actually likable.
I disagree with you about that.
And I think there are plenty of women who are very likable, but Elizabeth Warren is not among them.
I disagree with that. Everybody has, you know, everyone's personality has a Rorschach test. Some people hate Bernie's personality. Some people love it. Some people think Donald Trump is a total jackass. Some people love what he does. There's somebody like that.
Even I think, I can't stand Trump, and even I think he has a funny, like, likable side. I get why people like him.
When you saw Warren at her best in this campaign, she was weaving policy positions, emotional narrative and storytelling, and very sharp framing of issues. You know, she did a lot that was good for a campaign. There was a period where she was the best stump speaker in the campaign, and she had the crowds to prove it. So I don't think it's fair to say that she had a personality diva. I think she, at times, and certainly as things have gotten bleaker, where she comes across, you know, a little too edgy. But you could say that about any of the candidates who are having a tough time.
I'm probably not her target audience.
I mean, you know, she's been strongest with upper income, you know, PhD candidates, you know, which is not enough of a base to build a campaign off of.
I'm the son of a prison guard, Bill. That just doesn't, you know, I care about working people like Bernie.
I think of Elizabeth Warren, if being president was a lifelong dream for Elizabeth Warren, and she had a good decade of experience campaigning and working in African-American communities in the South, I think she could very well have been a very strong candidate. I think she has the capacity to do it. She hadn't done that her whole life. And you can't build those relationships on the fly.
I agree. We have to talk about the early voting thing.
Yeah.
Because this is a problem. I mean, this is a problem. And let's end early voting.
You're anti early voting across the board, which I'm not.
In general.
But I do think this is shown as early voting in primaries is pretty insane. Because, I mean, a primary situation is a much more fast-moving event than a general election. I mean, a general presidential election, there are not that many swing voters. There are not that many people who are like, and if you are one of those swing voters, don't vote early.
We had an election in 2000 that came down to one state. We had 77,000 people in three states elected Donald Trump. These things are close. So you're right. I mean, you're right that there aren't many, but every single vote counts. And look, I agree with you about the primary because people could drop out. And then if you voted for Mayor Pete, you've kind of wasted your vote. But I'm pretty sure early voting started before John McCain suspended his campaign in 08. I'm pretty sure early voting started before Donald Trump's Access Hollywood tape came out. You know, maybe we should wait and see how the campaign develops.
If you're a voter who has any capacity to toggle between parties, you should not early vote. You should wait to see what occurs. If you are a rock rib Democrat or a rock rib Republican, then it's a safer thing in a general election. In a primary, it's so fluid. There are debates, there are late breaking developments, people drop out, all sorts of things go on. And, you know, some folks have said to me, because I tweeted this, early voting in primaries is bad. And some people said, you can solve this with ranked choice voting. Partly, that solves the dropout problem. Ranked choice voting solves the dropout problem. It doesn't solve, oh, you were good in that debate. Oh, you're much better than I thought. I wish I could reconsider now. Like, that you can't do. Now, I did learn. I don't know how true this is for all the states.
And by the way, I just want to make a point. To reinforce what you just said, that is not a trivial thing. Yeah. There were a lot of voters who made up their mind to vote for Biden right at the end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The California exit poll numbers, Biden wins the vote in California for folks who made up their minds in the last 3 days, and he's in Nowheresville for before that, and most of the voters before that, because it's a mail-in state, so everyone does their stuff very early, or most people do, and so you miss the late-breaking developments.
And you could always theoretically argue, well, but the people who changed their mind they knew they might change their mind, and therefore they didn't vote early. I mean, it's hard to quantify that. I can tell you, and I'm sure you saw this, I saw tweets from people who were telling me, I voted for Pete and I wish I didn't because he's not in, or I voted for Amy. I saw, it's anecdotal, but I mean, we've seen examples of this.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. And I will be fine. I think that in a nominating process, in a primary, ranked choice voting would be perfectly fine. I prefer smoke-filled back rooms and bosses, but if that's not going to happen, this would be better.
So,
than what we have. So
to tie this off, if you're Bernie, what do you do?
Okay, let me first ask you. Mm-hmm. Give me the lay of the land. What next week is Super Tuesday 2?
I haven't got it in my Bloomberg suspense.
I believe we have a Super Tuesday 2 is next Tuesday.
I know there's some big states. Forgive me for having, you know, it's always annoying to have to sort of Google, you know.
Well, I mean, we just came through South Carolina in a debate and, you know.
But I know March 10th is Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Washington State. So,
all right, I'm calling that Super Tuesday too.
The 17th is Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Ohio. Arguably, that's maybe a little bigger than March 10th.
That's Super Tuesday 3.
Now, you probably give Mississippi and Missouri to Biden. North Dakota's a caucus, 14 delegates in the North Dakota caucus. You know, maybe you give that to Bernie, and Bernie's probably getting Washington State.
You betcha.
And Bernie could probably get Idaho. I mean, Bernie seems pretty good out west. But Michigan, you know, Michigan's the place where Bernie had the upset over Hillary in 2016, which gave the illusion he was more viable than he really was. I mean, Hillary still had the delegate math you know, firmly in her favor. Bree didn't even get that many delegates out of Michigan because it was a close race, but it was symbolically a sense of discontent with Hillary. If Bernie lost,
he might have been. Does make me wonder if Bernie might have been a better candidate against Donald Trump.
Well, people have translated that, of course, and she did lose Michigan in the general, but Hillary won Ohio in the primary and lost in the general, so these things don't automatically translate.
Yeah.
But if Bernie lost Michigan, the state that saved him, or you sort of quasi-saved him in 2016, that is a huge blow. And you would really have to make you wonder, what's the point of hanging around here? Now, he might hang around anyway, because I think Bernie, at the end of the day, is first and foremost building a movement to survive him, more so than just winning a particular contest. So he wants to be in every state, he wants to collect names, he wants to earn chits, he wants those people, and he wants to build a list that he hands over to AOC or whoever for the next contest. So I don't think he drops out regardless, but I do think if he loses Michigan, people are going to say, this is over.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Bernie, you stay in it. You know what I would do is look at what Donald Trump did. What was Trump's messaging? What did Trump do? What did Trump say? That would be, I mean, I hate to, it's bad for America, but it worked. I mean, I think he has to run this campaign of grievance, of anti-establishment. They're out to get me. They're out to get you. They're trying to take your vote away. He has to play that populist demagogic card, right?
And then try to
go to the convention.
I disagree. I don't think that is the sensible thing for him. I mean, when I give advice to people, I don't give advice about what I want you to do for my selfish purposes. Whenever I give advice to anybody in this show and my articles, it is, what do I think makes sense for your self-interest?
That's why I ask you for advice all the time.
I think Bernie's self-interest, I mean, so at some point he's going to have to know he's not getting the nomination. But he wants there to be a vibrant Democratic socialist movement that survives beyond him.
Let me just stop you. Let me just stop you for 1 second, because you're leaping to your premise is that Joe Biden will be the nominee.
Okay.
Am I correct?
Okay. Let me revise. Let's assume that Bernie is not making that calculation yet, that Biden is still a tenuous candidate. Something could still drop. His numbers against Trump.
You believe that? I'm operating under the assumption it is now game on. It is like, it's unclear to me who the nominee, but it sounds to me like you are assuming that this is Joe Biden's to lose now.
Well, that, yes, absolutely. I mean, my understanding is, and I know not quite all the delegates are in, but my understanding is that even after California comes in, Biden's going to be the delegate leader, even if it's not by a lot.
Really?
Forgive me if I'm getting that wrong, but it looks like that Bernie's margin in California is not big enough. My understanding is Bernie's margin in California, as we've seen to date, is not going to be big enough to overcome the other states that Biden has won. And I do not see in the subsequent map where Bernie overtakes Biden.
I think part of my discomfort is I still don't have a lot of faith in Joe Biden.
Well, that's why I would stop short of saying it's done, because Biden could do some kind of screw up, something else, some other random, whether it's true or false, scandal drops out and people buckle on him again.
Right.
You know, and so Bernie might want to say, who knows what happens with this guy? Yeah. He's a loose cannon. I gotta hang around.
You know, when I used to watch Redskins games, you know, and they might be up by a touchdown, but the quarterback just doesn't look, Kirk Cousins doesn't look good in the pocket. Every play, you're just holding your breath. Is he going to fumble? You know what I mean? And that's how I feel now about Joe.
And so that is an argument for Bernie staying in to the end, just in case. I mean, even if it's June, and the math is patently clear, what if something drops at the end of June? And Bernie and Biden's losing to Trump by 10 points in the trial heats. Then Bernie can make the play to the superdelegate or something like that. You know, so I get the logic of staying in. I do not think it makes sense for Bernie Sanders to ramp up the anti-democratic establishment message in this stage. Number one, if he's not going to be the delegate leader, he will need superdelegates who are democratic establishment. So that doesn't make sense on its face. Number two, he does not want to have his legacy be dividing the party so deeply that even if he nominally endorses by July, he gets blamed for the loss, and the well is poisoned between these factions of the party for the next several years. Number three, the ideological makeup of the party is not in favor of the Democratic Socialist, so just driving a hard ideological argument and blaming the establishment for disallowing it to happen, I don't think adds up. Now, if you want to build a Democratic Socialist movement that survives you, keep being a Democratic Socialist. Keep pushing your agenda. Keep saying you're the best candidate who can energize the youth vote. I think all that makes sense. I think trying to go hard negative on Biden doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't think he's going to call. I mean, a lot of times I'll say, look, you got to attack the guys ahead of you. I think a blunt attack like that runs the risk of getting blamed for whatever happens in the future. You can make a subtle attack in that I think I'm the more electable candidate because I'm better at base turnout, without making it personal. And considering that you're going to probably have to make a superdelegate play at the end of the day, if you have any shot at this, you don't want to anger those folks. You piss those guys off.
Okay. So based on your theory, you've laid out what you believe is the rational thing that you would advise Bernie to do.
Yes.
What is he more likely to do? What you've just said or what I said?
You know, I mean, you know, based on last night, I would not assume he takes that advice. Based on what happened in 2016, where he got, you know, harsher and harsher as the delegate math got worse and worse, doesn't engender confidence that he will take that sort of advice. But I think he does have pragmatic elements in his DNA. They're latent, but they exist and they have shown at other times. And I think he does feel very strongly that Donald Trump would be a disaster, and he does not dislike Joe Biden as a person. I take Bernie at his word on that. That they do not to say they're best of friends, but I do think he considers Joe Biden to be a decent individual who he just disagrees with on things. So I think there is some hope for him to say, you know what, I have to make sure I don't go scorched earth here and cause deep-seated problems are going to be very hard to fix post-convention.
Well, and by the way, I'm so glad, you know, you and I, we did another one of these emergency podcasts over at Matt Lewis and the News. We did a post-South Carolina, post-Pete exodus, pre-Super Tuesday podcast. I think we taped it Sunday night. And it was really good. And I'm so glad we did that, because not only was it a good episode, but like everything we said, we wouldn't have repeated hardly any of it. Right? I mean, because things have moved so fast since then and so much has changed. So I think the world, my point of this is, I think there may be a demand for us to do this twice a week, you know.
Well, we'll see.
It
depends how protracted this all gets. It might get, yeah. If it becomes clear that Biden's going to be the nominee and Bernie's just hanging around, we're going to be shifting to general election mode for pretty soon. But it depends on the next 2 weeks go.
All right. Another award-winning episode, Bill Scherer.
Great to talk to you. Get some sleep.
I will. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Rate and review. Let's try that. We've never said that. Rate and review this. If you're listening to this podcast and instead of watching it, you can rate and review. Also, sound off in the comments, Bill. And I would say lots of praise for both of us would be great in the comments today. So do that. And We'll see you back here in the DMZ next week.
All right. Take care.